This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Saving for retirement, easier said than done in some cases. Joining me this afternoon, as he does on the first Wednesday of every month, is financial advisor Chris DeSimeo. Also, financial planner David Foster with Foster & Motley. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Chris.
It's
long time no see.
You know, it seems like ages since we were here. We had
it's only been 4 weeks, Chris.
It's only been 4 weeks. But if you remember, a month ago we were, you know, running around. We were the Chicken Littles. The sky is falling. We have another government shutdown looming.
Right.
It's October, which is bad enough. And yet the market was up. Depending on which index you use, the S&P was up about 4% in October. It was a pretty good month.
Yeah, well, actually, it was a pretty good month.
It was a pretty reasonable month.
Mark Twain was wrong. October is not that horrible.
Well,
it wasn't in this case, at least.
Yeah. Anyway, and it's good to have our friend David Foster here. David was recognized it was just earlier this year, wasn't it, Dave?
Yes, it was.
As one of the 30 most influential professionals in the financial planning field in the whole United States. He's a certified financial planner. He's a CPA. You're a PFS, too, are you not?
I am not a PFS.
You're not a PFS.
No.
Okay.
Stay away from that. Yeah.
Are there any initials you do not have?
I just stick with the CFP, CPA. That was enough, you know. Yeah. Can only fit so much on a business card. So.
But Dave's been quoted in the Wall Street Journal, among other places, for many, many years. And anyway, we've had a lot of questions over the years about financial planning, especially retirement planning,
yes.
Because there are a lot of different ideas all kind of competing for our attention.
All kinds of ideas. And it is such a big issue. I think the one thing, though, that I have to ask Dave, you know, a lot of younger people, and I know this because I used to be one, they're always thinking, you know, retirement, that's so far away. That's 10 years, 20 years. I can wait 30 years before I start doing this. Mm-hmm. So my question is, you know, what's the compelling reason for waiting being such a bad idea?
Why is waiting a bad idea?
Yeah.
Well, it's just the power of, you know, compounded growth. I mean, that's the truth. If you can start putting money away, even if it's a small amount, into investments early on, it's just amazing how the numbers work out, as opposed to, you know, starting at age 42 or 38 or, heaven forbid, 55. It just makes a huge difference to allow something to set aside and get it growing earlier rather than later.
So is it true you might be able to put away a smaller amount and have it be much bigger if you have time on your side?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And especially, you know, we got these new things. Roth IRAs haven't been around too long. I mean, for younger folks, those are just tax-free accumulation vehicles for life. You know, a lot of my clients, of course, are older, but I talk to them about, hey, you got a 24-year-old just starting a job, see if you can get them to put $100 a month or you name it into a Roth IRA, or if they can't, offer to do it for them. I mean, because if you can start socking away a little bit of money in a Roth IRA in your 20s, it's a big deal.
Well, and Dave, that kind of gets to one of the other questions that we get a lot. Namely, let's say that you have a grown child, someone right out of college, and maybe they're not making a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. What are the mechanics of establishing a Roth IRA for one of your children who's recently out of college? In other words, there are income limits. Mm-hmm. If they make too much money, they can't have a Roth. If they're not making enough money, or let's say they're not even employed, they haven't found a job yet, mm-hmm. can you start putting money aside in a Roth IRA for someone who hasn't entered the workforce yet? These are questions that we get all the time.
Mm-hmm. The short answer is, yeah, you cannot do a Roth IRA unless you have earnings. So, yeah, if somebody's totally not employed for the whole calendar year, they can't put anything into a Roth, assuming they're single. Now, if they're married, you can do spousal IRAs and spousal Roth. So, yeah, you gotta talk those kids into at least delivering pizzas or something if they're looking for a better job, just to be able to put something into a Roth.
Yeah, the advantage, of course, with the Roth, unless this has changed, is that you don't get a tax deduction currently, so you're not reducing your current income, but the money grows tax-free, tax-deferred like a traditional IRA, but when you pull it out, you don't pay taxes on it. And that hasn't changed at all, has it?
Nope, that has not changed.
I've always been confused by the Roth versus traditional idea. I guess it just depends on your circumstances, too, what might be the better vehicle to use. Is it a good idea to maybe do a little bit of both, put a little retirement money in Roth, put a little bit of retirement money in a traditional plan?
Well, I'm not sure it makes sense to do a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA. It's probably pretty clearly one or the other, and it's probably a function of your tax bracket. Because the difference is, while we talk about the tax-free growth, if you do a traditional IRA and if you can deduct it, then you save on your taxes immediately. Whereas if you put money in a Roth, there is no immediate tax benefit. So simplistically, if you throw $6,000 into an IRA and you can deduct that, you might save $2,000, $2,500 on your tax return. In a Roth, you get no immediate tax savings. So, you know, that decision point is probably one of age and tax bracket. Now, if you're talking about traditional plans, you know, if someone has limited funds and maybe they can do their 401k at their employer versus a Roth IRA, that gets a little trickier. You know, then you get into matching issues and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And in fact, sometimes employers actually have a Roth 401k as an option.
Mm-hmm.
So it works just like
my wife's employer, for example, has that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It works just like a regular 401k. It comes right out of your check, but it doesn't reduce your income for tax purposes.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And let's speak to John from Dayton, Ohio. Good afternoon, John. What's your comment?
Okay, it is a comment. It's not a question. But I act as a financial advisor in the Dayton, Cincinnati, Columbus region. And I think that the conversation that we're having right now is very insightful, Roth versus traditional and all that and so forth. But the biggest problem, I think, for all of my clients is they aren't saving any money. And you can choose the best mutual fund, the best Roth 401k. You can have whatever's offered through your employer. But all of the clients that I meet with are saving 2% of their wages or 4% of their wages. And in the meantime, they're waking up and they're 60 years old and they've saved $50,000 or they saved $75,000. And frankly, that's just not enough savings. So my message to everybody out there in the audience is if you're not saving that, the number needs to be 10% or more. And where it comes from is a reduction in your standard of living. We need fewer iPhones, fewer European vacations, fewer NFL Sunday tickets, and more contributions to your retirement savings, or there's just going to be a tidal wave disaster coming in the next 10 to 20 years.
John, thank you. Great comment.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
Yeah, it.
John, if you could hear the sound of heads nodding up and down, you just heard it. you just heard it. Thanks so much, John. You know, it really is true that if you're spending more than you're taking in, if you look at yourself as a business, you are in net liquidation. Mm-hmm. You're going to be in trouble unless you inherit something, which is not a good thing to build a financial plan around, or you're planning on winning the lottery or getting lucky at the casino, which also is not a good thing to build a plan around. Mm-hmm. How hard has it? I mean, how tough is it when you're just starting out? Dave Foster, when you're, let's say you work at an employer, what's the hierarchy of determining how much to save, as John just talked about? Do you at least save as much as the employer matches, even if it hurts? Do you not leave that free money on the table, or do you say, look, I don't want to do it inside the plan, I'll do my own first?
Well, that issue of the employer match, I mean, I think it's important to try and get that, so because that's just sort of free money. You know, if you can put 4% away and they'll chip in 2%, well, you got a 50% return basically from the get-go. So that's hard to pass up. You know, John's right. I mean, people just need to make sacrifices. I mean, that's the truth. It's you know, if you're – you know, the way I think about it sometimes, I'll say to people, hey, maybe your decent earning years are 30 to 60, and if you might live from 60 to 90, you really think saving 5 or 10% – I mean, that's – 30 years in work, 30 years in retirement. I mean, you got to save a lot of money to really make that work. So it's a big number. So, get the match and then some.
David, what's the ideal amount? Somebody makes an X amount of dollars all their working life. In retirement, is there a percentage of that they should shoot for hanging on to? I should still get, you know, if I make $80,000 a year, I should in retirement, I should have this much that I can pull out every year? Is like 80% or 60%?
What is the rule of thumb, I guess?
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of rules of thumb when it comes to that kind of thing. But I tell people, of course, you know, our clients honestly tend to be more affluent. I mean, that's the truth, the people that we work with. So, but I tell people to start with whatever they're spending now. means 100% of their pre-retirement needs, unless there's obvious things that are going to drop off. College tuition for college-age kids.
A mortgage, for example.
Yeah, I mean those. But, you know, not that many people, at least in their early retirement years, are still healthy, feeling good. I mean, they're still spending money on stuff. You know, maybe it drops off when they're 75, 80, but then healthcare might fill in where the traveling is dropping off. So I think it's safe to just say 100% other than the stuff that you know is going to go away.
So save.
Yeah, I mean,
as much as you can, right?
Otherwise, like John said, you're going to wake up and say, man, Chris and I were talking about this the other day. We got, you know, even somebody that has, you know, $300,000 or $400,000 in a retirement account, which might sound like a lot of money, if you withdraw 5% a year of $400,000, that's $20,000. That's not very much. To maintain a lifestyle where you might have been used to spending $60,000 or $70,000 or $80,000. Save.
Yeah, and especially with when you think about retirement planning, one of the pillars of that has been some kind of pension, which from a private source has
become. What's a pension?
Yeah, well, that's the main. They become increasingly rare. And then there's Social Security, which, you know, there's concern as to where that's going to be there. But if you understand how that is constructed, you have to understand what your Social Security benefit is likely to be. There are ways to maximize it. And then finally, then you have to make a call on your own how much of that you want to count on. But when you subtract that from the amount of money that you need, and then you arrive at your number. And a lot of plans have gone up in smoke because if you use the average of the stock market's return, which is about 10% going back to 1926, and assume that that's what you're going to get, you run a huge risk because averages are average just for that reason. It's all the numbers added up. And if you hit it wrong, if you have $1 million and you think, okay, I'm okay, I can take $100,000 a year out, and you take your $100,000 out and the market drops by 40%, within a year, you've lost half your portfolio. And so having a number that's more sustainable and figuring out what that is really critical. And that's, you know, and it's a lower number than 10%.
And that's a great point because I know personally, as somebody who's trying to save for retirement, one of the things that often discourages me, we're talking about people just don't save enough. I always see these commercials and hear these suggestions. Well, you need $1 million. You need, and I'm sitting here going, I'm not going to get there. I started late. I'm doing the best I can, but I'm not going to have that. So why bother? I think sometimes that's the attitude that people are running up against.
Well, and that's where having a good, long, hard look in the mirror or a joint look in the mirror with your significant other about what kind of lifestyle you want. Mm-hmm. Do you really need two cars? Do you need to replace them every 2 years or not? Do you need, you know, these are lifestyle choices. Mm-hmm.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Tom from Oxford. Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Or afternoon. Thanks. I'm fine.
Good. What's your comment?
Well, you guys have been talking from a mile-high perspective, and I've got more of a perspective that's about 100 yards high.
Okay.
Here's the deal. I have a graduate degree from the School of Bad Investment Ideas and Decisions.
So, the School of Hard Knocks?
Well, that's the counter title. Yeah.
Did you do postdoctoral work in that?
I've got some. Yes, and that's what I wanted to talk about. So I've come up with a really simple plan of investing, actually endorsed by none other than Warren Buffett, and I want to pass it along and see what you guys think of it.
Go ahead.
Can I do that?
Well, yes, okay, but please try what we try to do, since this is public radio. We can't have any kind of commercial endorsement. And if possible, do not use the actual name of a specific mutual fund.
Okay. Here it is then.
There's your challenge.
Keep it simple. All right. To keep it simple, you invest in only one security, an index fund that precisely tracks the Dow Jones average. Now, I could give you the name of it, but I won't.
Okay. Easy enough to find, though.
So that's the big deal. It's just one fund. Now, I know that, kind of invalidates the idea of diversification, but I can give arguments for that.
Well, if it tracks the Dow, it's 30 stocks, though, if it tracks the Dow. So that's
right.
Somewhat diversified.
And it's also international diversified because every one of them have a big
global component.
Yeah, global component.
Mm-hmm.
So make monthly investments regardless of what the market is doing. As you guys mentioned, you're looking at 30 years plus 30 years. You're looking at a 60-year horizon. Don't look at what the market does today or tomorrow or next year or the year after. Keep investing. Then use a broker that will allow you to pull money out of your checking account monthly, and one that will allow you to do partial investments in index funds. There aren't many of those. I could give you the name of one, but I can't. And that's it.
And you know, it's interesting,
simple.
Too, John, you bring up a great point. Back in until the 1970s, there were no index funds. I mean, there were indices, but there was no way to invest in an index fund until John Bogle came up with this idea of – and I mean, that whole premise was that since most money managers, active managers, didn't beat the market, if you could just be the market instead of trying to beat the market, then you'd be okay. Mm-hmm. And you get transparency, you get liquidity. And about 20 years ago, it's hard to believe, it's been since 1994, I think, when the S&P 500 became available as a as something that you could trade on an exchange instead of being only being allowed to do it once a day after the market closed. And you can be as specific as you want. You can be as broad as you want with these. One of the things you may want to think about also in your work, in your post-postdoctoral work, is to consider looking at ways that indices are constructed. Jeremy Siegel, who wrote the book Stocks for the Long Run back in 1994, has been active in looking, taking the components of an index and instead of weighting them by price, which is what the Dow Jones Industrial Average does, that index is influenced by the price of a stock, not by the quality of the stock, not by the size of the company, or the S&P 500, which is simply using the size of the company. There are newer kinds of index funds that give you the low cost and the transparency and the tradability that you can also buy through discount brokers, or if you're working with a fee-only financial planner, there are no commissions to buy these things. And you can have these index funds that are based on qualitative factors. And you can judge for yourself on any the number of online resources whether these are better or not as good as the cap-weighted or price-weighted indices.
And we'd like to thank Tom for his comment. And, you know, Tom brought up another good point, too. Consistency in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Be consistent. He's in, he's doing this every month consistently. And I think that, that plays a big role in succeeding at this.
Yeah, I think that was the key to, you know, if you got a plan, whether it's the Dow Jones, whether it's the broader S&P 500, whether it's the world stock market, pick something, do it with religious fervor, and just keep doing it, and it'll work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the bobbing and weaving with, you know, what you heard at work that day or what you heard on the news. That's what hurts people financially. I you know, the only critique I would have is I would use a broader market index than just the Dow Jones 30. But beyond that, that'll work if somebody sticks with it.
Yeah, it's amazing how few people are aware of the Dow being price weighted. So a company whose share price, which is a totally arbitrary number, it's pulled out of thin air. I mean, if a company splits its stock 2-for-1, the number of shares doubles, the price is cut in half. But that influences the index. So if 29 of those stocks do nothing and one of them has a really good or really bad day, it will make the index deviate wildly from the broader market.
We'll continue our conversation about saving and investing for retirement after the break. Let us know how you're dealing with it or call up and ask a question. 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. In about 11 minutes in Focus on Technology, Ann Thompson tells us about expanding biotechnology in Southwest Ohio. And meantime, we continue our conversation about investing for retirement with Chris DeSimio and David Foster. Let's take a call from Steve in Blue Ash. Good afternoon, Steve. What's your question?
Well, I'll just give you a little background for starters. I lost about everything in 2008. It took me a couple of years to find the right job again, but I'm in a nice position, and I just turned 55, and I figure I'll be working until I'm 70. What do I need to do to get rebuild my nest egg? I took a big bath, and while I have a real good job, I could probably save up to 40%. Where should I go? Where should I put it? Help.
You sound like a lot of us, Steve. Yeah.
Operators are standing by.
Dave. Yeah, no kidding.
No, no, I feel your pain. I know where you're coming from, Steve.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's a significant opportunity, but it's also a significant conundrum.
Steve, thanks for the question. We appreciate it very much, and we'll have Dave and Chris here mull it over for you.
Well, if the question is sort of where to invest his excess savings, you know, he's got to figure out how risky he wants to be. Obviously, he's gone through a pretty bad market. Now, you know, that said, folks who kind of were able to stick through it, sounds like Steve had a job issue that might have caused him to eat up some of his savings as well. But, you know, if you can stick through things through thick and thin, you can be a little aggressive. He's still young. Like we talked about, he might have 40 years. So he needs to pick an investment allocation. Maybe it's 60% stocks, 40% bonds, and then execute a plan. I mean, similar to what we were talking with the previous caller. I mean, you know, I don't care if it's a target date fund from some good mutual fund firm. Just, you know, do it, Steve, and stick with it.
And don't you have what are called catch-up opportunities nowadays? You can add additional money beyond what the government would normally allow you to put into a retirement plan?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he has some opportunities, given his age, of throwing a little extra into a 401k, like $5,000, and a little more into an IRA. So, yeah, he needs to explore all those tax-advantaged options that might be available through his employer and elsewhere. But so that's kind of step one. But then that investment thing might have been, I heard the hang up in his voice, but gee, I don't want to get burned again kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. The limits this year, the IRS just came out with the 2014 limits. They're 17.5 if you're under age 50. And if you're over 50, you can toss an additional $5,500 in to a regular, to a 401k plan or a 403b plan. That's serious money. Mm-hmm. And there's a gentleman who was on last month with us, William Bernstein, who's written a number of great books. I'm holding one in my hand, Deep Risk. But he talks about one of the greatest unknown things out there. If you're going to work, and it sounds like Steve might work till he's 70. Mm-hmm. If you delay receiving your Social Security benefits, even though you may qualify for them at age 66, if you delay them until 70, your number goes up by 8% per year. So William Bernstein's idea is, well, drain for those 4 years, drain your retirement buckets while you're getting a guaranteed 8% increase in your income. Now, you want to know how healthy you are before you embark on that.
we had Brandon call and he wanted to know, he says, we're talking like people have money. He says, what advice for those of us who are just starting out, first job or with low-paying jobs? How do you save while paying rent and buying groceries? And my advice, personal experience, save whatever you can.
Save till it hurts. I mean, you have to start something, and through your employer is the very best way. And if you can't, then save and set up some kind of IRA account first. You have to.
Mm-hmm. And there are now, and this wasn't true 20 years ago. I mean, there are some of the discount brokers and mutual funds and other places. You can buy exchange-traded funds and other things, no commission. I mean, so $25 a month, I mean, you can set up accounts and get things rolling at some of these places that – really, you couldn't do 15 or 20 years ago.
The costs were too prohibitive.
They were, yeah.
And now those barriers have been removed. And just to get it started, because remember that the IRS is going to help you out. You're going to get a current tax deduction for whatever you save.
Well, and then there's retirement savers credit that not many people know about. But
explain that.
Well, you know, I almost have to always look up the details. But if your income's pretty low, you know, say under $25,000 or $30,000, and you set up an IRA, you're able to make contributions, not only do you get the tax benefit, you might actually get a credit of several hundred dollars on your tax return that year. It's called the Retirement Savers Credit.
And someone could go to the IRS's website, irs.gov, and type that in and get all the information they need.
And you gentlemen are correct. I mean, nowadays there are lots of opportunities where you can invest small amounts of money if that's all you can do. I mean, I know there are some plans out there where you can do as little as $5.
Yeah.
And so there are all kinds of possibilities if you do your homework. Let's talk to Zachariah from Clifton. Good afternoon.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
I was wondering, I'm a recent college graduate. I got a great job. I save about 20% a year. That's my goal between company, 401k, and the Roth IRA. So I'm not really terribly worried about accumulating enough money by the time I retire, unless there is like a market failure of some type, maybe like a depression or like strong recession. And I was wondering, is there any way to hedge against that kind of scenario? Maybe it's like a put or a call or something, or how could I feel more secure about that?
Good question. Thank you, Zachariah.
That's a great question. I mean, these are really wonderful questions. Mm-hmm. David, I mean,
how old are you, Zachariah? Is he 22, 24, 25?
He just started working.
I wouldn't worry about hedging. I mean, honestly, he's got a long enough time period. You know, hedging costs money. Hedging is paying an insurance premium. And in the long run, that premium will reduce your investment returns. Now, somebody 48 or 56 or 62, hedging is entirely reasonable to start to look at. And that can be done with just holding more cash. That's kind of a cheap hedge. But there are lots of ways and probably more complicated than we can go into that people can do that. But.
Yeah. Again, in his book, Deep Risk, by one of these mini books, if you go to any online bookstore, bookseller by William Bernstein, he talks about just that kind of thing. How do you hedge against – and is it worthwhile to hedge against a deep risk, like deflation, like a depression? Mm-hmm. How common is it and how expensive is it to insure or protect against that as opposed to hedging against the more common risk of inflation? So understand what your true risk is and figure out how much you want to allocate towards it, because there are some very expensive hedges that might be working against you if you're insuring against the wrong thing.
And his risk of short-term market volatility is not worth hedging.
That's your friend. I mean, if you're buying shares, that's your friend.
If you're young, boy, you want to buy in those opportunities, yep.
Let's speak with Barbara from Batavia. Good afternoon, Barbara.
Yes, hello. I'm 62 years old. I am retired, so I am drawing that. And I have a pension. I have about $400,000 in my 401k. My question is, I'm receiving $30,000 from my mom. She passed away. It's an inheritance, and I just wanted to know the best way to do that. Should I pay off my college loans that I still have? For my children, should I reduce my house payment, or should I invest in a 401k?
So your question is, what's the good starting point for you?
We've got 3 minutes. David, go.
All right. Pay off anything that's got high interest. I mean, because you make so little. I mean, if you got one of those student loans that you're planning on paying off anyway for your kids, and it's at 6 or 7 or 8%, there's no way you're going to get a guaranteed 6 or 7 or 8%.
Exactly. Exactly. Pay those off first. Now, can she? She can't roll an inheritance, of course, over into a 401k plan.
No.
Is she still working? Are you still working?
I work part time, but because I'm collecting Social Security, I can't make over, I believe it's $15,000.
That's right. But David, as a CPA, could she, even though she's working part time, could she then reduce her taxes even more by saving more money, spending down the inheritance, paying off bills, and then saving, adding to her retirement savings?
Sure. She could do an IRA. She could probably even do a Roth, depending on her adjusted gross income level. So, whether that makes sense or not is, again, based on her – sounds like her marginal bracket might not be too high, but paying off debt and just setting it aside for a rainy day is not a bad thing to do.
Thank you for your question, Barbara. And time for one more phone call. Got about 1 minute here. Let's talk to Robert from Loveland. Hi, Robert.
Yes, for my children. I'm 52, but I want them to start saving with IRAs. What are the rules about when they can start saving for IRAs if we pay them to do household chores or whatever?
Okay, Robert, good question.
Great. Well, there's really no age limit. I mean, if you got a 14-year-old who actually has earnings, let's say they make $600 babysitting and cutting grass, you can put $600 into a custodial IRA. So you got to jump through some hoops it's got to be like at a brokerage firm or mutual fund company, but it can be done. I will say I did it with my kids, and they're like, "Dad, why do you want to know how much I made babysitting this year?" I'm like, "Look, we got to put it down.
You're not going to confiscate it. You're
just got to know."
Yeah. So they can start early, and as long as there's earned income. Okay.
Yeah, and the idea of paying your kids for household chores is a little. The key is you have to file a tax return for the kids, and you have to pick it up as income. So I think it works better if they're being paid for babysitting or grass cutting or something.
Yeah, great.
Well, thank you for joining me this afternoon. Financial advisor Chris DeSimeo and financial planner David Foster with Foster and Motley.